investigation from the Department of State and Agency and also the delegation from the SADS. Is that correct? Yeah, I have to be very careful that I don't promote a liquor outlet. Welcome to all of you folks. And I should also ask the presenters to be mindful of the fact that we have allocated you 20 minutes. If we go into injury time, it will be 30. But when we strike 30, it will be a red card. So we are in your able hands. Mr. Charlton.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for the opportunity. The submission that we have made in writing is quite long, so I would like to save the committee's time by just touching on the important issues. The submission, first and foremost, where we do refer to Section 3 of the bill, should in fact be referring to Section 13, the difference between the original publication and the final publication in the Government Gazette. But I'll deal with that as we go along. Representing NAMSA, the National Association of Vehicle Manufacturers of South Africa, who have had the pleasure and honor of working closely with the SABS over many years. And I believe we've had a good working relationship. And NAMSA in the earlier period supported the separation of the two entities of testing and certification from the regulatory aspect. I think more than anything, our biggest concern lies with Section 3, which is correctly termed Section 13. And under points 1A and B of Section 13, the minister is entitled to make a SANS specification mandatory. We like that, we support that, because that means that before something is made mandatory, it has been through the full processes laid down under the STANDA, the SABS specification development system. And these full processes ensure full stakeholder participation, ensure adequate consultation with all the role players, which means that a standard is developed and then made compulsory. What we are concerned with, Mr. Chairman, is subsection C, which appears to override the provisions of A and B and would permit the minister to make any standard mandatory. We don't quite know what is meant by that, and we're very concerned that it might enable the minister or the regulator to bypass the standard processes. Having said that, we have seen examples of where this type of thing has been happening, and we're very concerned. We don't wish to see it happening in the future. And we would propose that subsection C be deleted. Moving on from that, we had great difficulties in the past, and I'm going back 10 years, 8 years, whatever, when we found that the SABS, or the then regulator, was haphazardly changing some of the procedures which have an interdependency with the standards that have been developed according to due process. And we have found in industry that a change in the procedures, or a change in the supporting information even, that is required in terms of a compulsory standard or compulsory requirement, almost an administrative requirement, can have a greater effect on business confidence and certainty than the compulsory safety standard itself. So, Mr. Chairman, what we are looking for is a guarantee, if not an amendment to the bill, and we have in fact proposed an amendment which would enshrine those procedures and those supporting rules in the bill as processes and procedures which have to be developed through the standard processes and become standards in themselves, which of course can be referred to in the compulsory standards. So, Mr. Chairman, we wish to support the move that everything goes through the standard process, which is either going to be a compulsory specification per se or a supporting requirement. We have listed in Appendix 1 and 2 examples of things which it is vital that industry has certainty on, and it is vital that all stakeholders have an input on. And even, for example, the data package, which has to accompany a new vehicle model when it is submitted for approval or homologation to the regulator. Such requirements can be changed currently at the whim of the regulator or the SABS. We don't mind the changes. In fact, we would support many changes, but we want to see them being given due process and follow the standard process. I think that's our first point, Mr. Chairman, to put an end to ad hoc changes which catch industry by surprise and have not been properly exposed to stakeholders. In saying that, we would not like to see these issues the subject of regulations, because regulations as such can be formulated in a unilateral basis, and it's always difficult to move from that position, whereas a standard is formulated in a multilateral background, and what comes out from a standard is usually better than what comes out from a regulation. I say that advisedly, having spent a couple of years now at the receiving end of Department of Transport regulations on the taxi recapitalization program, where if only such processes had been exposed to the SABS standard processes, we would not be in the uncertain position that we are today. So the next point is that we haven't been able to find anything in the bill which would permit the regulator to require something which is not expressly provided in the legislation. When I say legislation, I mean in the specifications and standards which have gone through the standard processes. And yet, we have been exposed to additional requirements which can be made by a regulatory department and which the industry feels it has to kowtow to in order to go through the processes, in order to market the vehicles, the new models which it is bringing to the market. So we could not find anything in the bill which gives the regulator the power to make, shall we say, ad hoc decisions or make requirements which are additional to what is in the law. And so long as that is the case, so long as the regulator does not have discretionary powers but has recourse to the standard processes if he wishes to change something, we are happy. Moving on, the next point has been something that has concerned the industry too, and that is the levy. What is currently termed the levy, and which in future will be termed a fee. Industry is quite happy to pay fees per unit, per vehicle produced, and in the past have seen these fees going to testing and certification, going to standards development for automotive matters, and going to the regulatory function. These fees from norms alone probably amount to about $15 million a year, from the total industry to, I don't know, $20 or $30 million a year. We have been very, very surprised that financial income to the SCBS, which used to serve a multitude of automotive engineering functions, is now being focused and channeled, as we understand it, purely to one of those functions, being regulatory. And, of course, the fees have risen considerably in recent years. We wonder what has happened to those funds over the years. We would like to have thought that the funds would have finished up in a pool which could be used to support improvements in standards, improvements in test equipment, and which would enable the motor manufacturing industry to move forward in terms of the safety standards which are available in the world, which NAMSA members would like to move on to. Currently, we are loath to propose improvements and additional standards until the regulatory functions have settled down. But we will continue to see a need for certain testing activities, be they the more specialized ones, to be supported financially by government funding. And we would like to know whether the levies that have been paid to the Bureau over the years, since they couldn't possibly have been spent totally by the regulatory function, we would like to know or think that some of that fund would continue in the future to support new services, new standards, new testing equipment. Not all, because part of the function of the separation is to enable those testing services which can be viable to be separated and be made viable. We have heard a lot about the technical regulatory framework which is being developed by DVI, and we strongly support that. And we would love to see other government departments resorting to the STANZA specification development services. And we would certainly like to wish to ensure that when our regulator changes the rules or introduces new standards or new processes or new requirements or new procedures, that he would also make use of the STANZA processes and not simply gazette regulations. Then I think almost as a last item, Mr. Chairman, we are concerned that there have been ups and downs in the service levels of the SCBS on testing and certification and on the regulatory function. We're concerned right now that with further staff changes, that there could be a trough, a hollow, a slide in terms of service delivery. We sincerely hope that that will not be the case. But if it were to happen, it would mean that we could not complete the processes quickly enough that are necessary to meet launch dates for new vehicles, and it could have very serious consequences on an industry or on a particular manufacturer if his planning is upset because a particular procedure cannot be completed because of an inadequate service level at testing and certification or at regulatory. And we wish to just register that deep concern that we must have adequate levels of service. So, Mr. Chairman, in conclusion, the main issue that we would like to see clarified and agreed upon is that item 3C, 13C, sorry, should be deleted, and our proposal would then be that anything that is made compulsory has been through the stanza processes, and any procedure or any requirement which interacts and impacts upon the application of a compulsory standard must also go through your same standard processes. I used the example of a data package. It should be agreed upon in a technical committee of the SEDS. It should be open to stakeholders to comment. It should go through this process before it is referred to in legislation. The same would go for what types of test reports, for example, are acceptable to the regulator. The same should go for what types of conformity of production requirements or agreements to be reached. These might sound like incidentals compared with the safety of the vehicle when it hits a wall or how good its brakes are, but they can have a much greater impact on the efficient functioning of industry, which is meeting the standards anyway, than the standards themselves. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. I'll avail the opportunity to members for comment and questions for clarification. Prof. Shirok.
It's after lunch, so you'll forgive me. I'm not sure what the standard process is. Is it in the documentation somewhere? Perhaps somebody can enlighten me. Secondly, am I to understand that you have that the presenter has no objection to the separation of the two bills, to the separation, and in fact welcome. Thirdly, why? If he can explain why he thinks it's a good idea.
Mr. Chair, I wanted to ask for some clarification in terms of your comment that SABS and the regulatory structures have demonstrated that they actually cannot manage the workload and technical demands. Could you give us some examples of that? Because we'd like to just get some clarity with regard to your experiences with regard to SEPs and their technical responsibility. That would help us to actually determine the role of SEPs as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Comrade Hutman.
Thank you, Chairperson. In the same line, Honorable Mohammed, I would want to get more information around the concerns that you have raised with regards to regulatory problems and as well as the standards for testing. Exactly what problems do you have with those two things?
Thank you. Dr. Ravisa.
Chairman, thank you. I just want to ask the spokesperson, I mean, we part of the international sort of global economic network. Now, our standards here, is it comparable to the rest of the developing world? I think it's extremely important for our consumers and so forth that our standards is on par with the rest of the world, and I'd like to have his views on that. I think if you look at our accident rate, Mr. Chairman, which is really a reason for grave concern, so I think it's very important that we retain and that we benchmark our safety standards with the rest of the world. Thank you.
I would like to avail you the opportunity for a rejoinder. and I see you are with your colleague. If you want him to fuse parts of it, you may do so.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Firstly, the standard process, Mr. Fisher over there could explain it far better than I, but very briefly, it means that you produce a technical regulation by engaging in technical committees, that the membership of the technical committee is carefully thought out and approved by a more senior body. The process that is followed with draft number one and draft number two and committee meeting this, that, and the next thing are in line with the international standards organization processes and are referred to in the WTO-TBT agreement. And so they're internationally compatible for setting technical regulations. It's an arena where every stakeholder can have representation on the technical committee, and there, even after the specification has been completed, it is circulated to a wide audience nationally and internationally. Does that answer that question, Mr. Chairman? Thank you. The second question then was, does NAMSA support the bill? In essence, NAMSA supports the bill, subject to deletion of subsection 13C and its replacement by our proposal, which more or less says that any supporting procedures or requirements that interact with the compulsory specification should also go through the standard process. The third point, I believe, was why is the separation such a good idea? Some years ago, a review was made of the South African Bureau of Standards by an international group to try to bring it in line with international practice. And the bottom line really was that the player and the referee should be separated. We support that concept, and we also support the notion that certain of the testing services should not be subsidized, but should be open to free and fair competition from the private sector. But we certainly concluded that some of the testing services and certainly some of the future testing services would have to be subsidized or would have to be government run. Our concern these days would be that we have split the skill base. Our concern is that previously there was a huge sharing of information and knowledge between those who wrote the standards, applied the standards, did the testing, and did the regulation, did the surveillance, and did the inspections, which said that that will be lost to a degree. We're also sad to see that there has been very, very high staff turnover amongst the skills and expertise at the SCBS, in that as new incumbents were trained up, we found they've been attracted by offers from ESCOM, even from our own industry. And so there's a constant renewal and retraining, leaving the skills level perhaps lower than it might be. And I think we seem to be going through another cycle of people leaving the SABS or leaving the functions they were previously handling. Does that too? If I may go on then. SADS and technical regulatory. I'm losing it here. Yes, we wanted enlightenment as to what concerns we had with levels of service. Again, going back to the levy had increased over the years. Promises of additional staff to the tune of, I think, figures of 18 and 24 were mentioned in terms of the increase in levies that it was supposed to provide. That didn't necessarily happen for one or other reason. But as much as anything, our concern is with whether the staff can be retained at SAMS those with the skills and those who've been trained up of late. Because if they go, it means that the homologation process, horrible word, cannot be completed quickly. The vehicles cannot be tested quickly, and therefore they cannot be sold. That's our main concern. And Dr. Robbie asked at the end whether our standards were in line with international norms. They are not up to date with international norms. The motor manufacturing industry, NAMSA, has taken a high-level decision that they would like to push forward and reach these international norms, to a greater extent at least, so that we can operate on a basis, a minimum baseline for free and fair competition above which trading can take place, which would limit perhaps unfair, unsafe competition coming into the country. But in order to move forward, it becomes progressively more expensive in terms of testing equipment, and we need testing equipment to support new standards. If you go for the more sophisticated forward impact and side impact, for example, you simply need a dummy. But that dummy might cost you 10 million rand. The laboratory to calibrate that dummy might cost you 30 million rand. And you cannot just run a test now and again because you haven't got the retention of the skills to do it. It's okay for an international organization which is running these tests on a weekly basis, where you keep your hand in, you keep trained. But if you only do it once every 6 months or 12 months, you will never get it right first time. So we're reaching the area of diminishing returns also in terms of capital expenditure on testing equipment. But there is no way that a levy could fund it. We need support from government. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, sir. Any other areas for clarification? Comment? Ian. Mr. Charlton, we have your more extensive submission. We'll obviously revert to it in our further deliberations on this issue. We thank you for your submission. We now go to the next submission. Mr. John Wilson.
Mr. Chairman, I'm terribly sorry. Could I just add one short comment?
You may.
Thank you very much, Mr. Morrison. The question is put, are our standards in line with international norms? The answer I said was no. The regulatory standards we have are not. But many of the vehicles that are sold are. But some of the vehicles only meet the minimum requirements which we have. Thank you.
The nature of your answer is such that it would invite further questions. Namely, there are people who are driving motor vehicles here. The immediate question would be, is my vehicle compliant or not? Now, the nature of that discussion is such that the detour might become the journey. I'll allow you a few seconds to put people at rest.
Mr. Chairman, the answer there is we do have a series of compulsory safety standards which we believe are met by all manufacturers and importers, and this is the law of the country under the regulator. But because we're not necessarily up to date with international norms in every respect, There are many vehicles which are being sold here which are up to those international norms. And of course, there are some coming into the country which will just meet the existing South African legislation. So NAMSA would support movement towards the adoption of more of the later standards that are used internationally. But that's quite a process to go through, and we're keen to engage in it. But we need to be sure that we have a regulatory and a testing and service support system for these that have the skills to apply them. And we mustn't forget, too, that there are many manufacturers who also exceed the international norms in their vehicles.
Professor Churok, I'll indulge you, because whilst Mr. Wilson was speaking, I was looking at your expression, and it was a very perplexed one and worried.
Yes, Chair, I mean, it is a bit odd that we're in our own vehicles comply internationally, but imported don't. I find that, if I understand it rightly. Oh, but he did say that some of the imported vehicles do not comply with the international standards. Did I understand that right or not?
I'll give him a chance for yet another rejoinder. But could you kindly be frank and leave the parables for Sunday in church?
Mr. Chairman, there are three levels, shall we say, there are four levels of compliance. One, non-compliance with South African standards, which we hope is not occurring. Two, compliance with South African standards, which are not as good as the latest in Europe. Not all of them. Three, there are vehicles being manufactured locally and imported, which meet the international requirements. And four, there are vehicles being manufactured locally and imported, which exceed the international norms. More than that, I'm not sure that I can say. Does that help, Mr. Chair?
From the Chair, I will thank you for your contribution. But from Professor Churok's expression, he says that you have an option of a career in Parliament. Good folks, we'll go to the presentation number C. That's Mr. John Wilson. Welcome, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, my name is John Wilson. I'm here to represent the National Laboratory Association. It is an association of the laboratories, the majority of the laboratories around the country that do the testing function. In virtually any field that you can think of, and as well as calibration. Calibration is making sure that the measurements are correct and traceable to international standards. As an organization, we'd first of all like to compliment the DTI on the original document, which was the restructure of the South African Technical Regulation Infrastructure. A lot of research, thought, and hard work went into that document, and as an association, we really like what that document says. In line with that, the implementation of that document has brought into place SANAS, the South African National Accreditation System, as a separate entity. It has also now just very recently brought into place NAMISA, the National Metrology Institute of South Africa. And in both of those cases, it is very clear to the association that the local as well as the international regard for those entities has certainly gone up. It makes it very clear who they are and what their job is, and very much better accepted. Our response to the two documents is in a very much broader base than the previous speaker. Really, we feel that what we would just like to see is a very clear and independent regulator. At the moment, that's not clear. In some fields, you really have to search to find out who the regulator is and what they do. We'd also like to see a very clear role of the standards body in the form of STANZA. We'd like very much when the processes follow the way that they should. The access to technical people, the process that's already been discussed is clear, and as long as that is used as a process, it is very good. We believe that by separating out the standard or the standard writing portion of SABS, as well as the regulator, will allow for much better harmonization between the various bodies. And that includes then the National Metrology Institute and STANAC. And if you look at the roles, you really are in a situation where if a document is written, a standard is written through the standard process, and that document is then clearly measured to see that it can actually be implemented, which currently doesn't really happen. You sometimes get a regulation that's sort of thrown in that cannot be implemented. We don't have the tools, the expertise to even do this. In some cases, measurements that just can't be performed. And if it goes through the proper standard process, that will be eliminated. You then have the other bodies that will make sure that those standards are correctly implemented. And that is done through the standards process with accredited laboratories that you know are competent to do the work and are recognized internationally. We also believe that if it is structured correctly, that you can make the best use of the expertise that we have from the various fields. Currently, the other organizations have got technical bodies. The standard process has technical bodies, and they all, I wouldn't say share resources, but they draw from industry and from the national lab and from other forms so that all of the aspects are covered. We believe that by especially bringing the regulator under a separate body, that you will get some harmonization between the different state departments as to how regulations are approached, that they are then put in place with proper standards that they can be measured against, and then that the process is very clear. We also support the advisory forums. This is was trying to start with, but works well, where you have an opportunity for industry to get firsthand what information is trying to be passed down the line, and then in return the DTI gets firsthand what industry says is actually happening in the field. So when you look at examples, as you just heard from the previous speaker, that things just happen, and sometimes there aren't channels for that information to come back to the state. This way, at least, there are very clear channels in both directions, and we would support that as well. If one were to look at what would have been the first submission by Senate, we'll see very many of those points are the same, and I think it's very similar to the concerns that the previous speaker raised. I believe, on behalf of the Laboratory Association, that you should proceed with the two bills. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Wilson, thank you very much. In Afrikaans, there's an expression, kort en bondig. Suppose a loose translation to English would be short and sweet. Members, time for comments, questions, areas of clarity. Dr. Hasmin.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, Mr. Wilson will pardon me to ask other questions that he might not venture into. The first is in relation with the constitution of the board for the two entities. What is your view, and what size do you think the board must be constituted with the number of people? So, and the second question is around the forums that you support. On whose expense should they operate? Do you think that they should operate on the budget of the state, on whose cost should they do their work. Thank you.
Thanks, Dr. Hassan. I can't see any. Farida, your hand up.
Yeah, I think I'm just going to make a general comment with regard to your presentation, sir. It does please us that you have no problem with our two pieces of legislation that hopefully will be promulgated. I want to say, through your experiences, did you experience capacity problems or in terms of your your experience with these regulatory bodies, did you have any problems with regard to your institution, and what were they?
Thank you. A chance for you to join us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Regarding the first two questions, I guess they're fairly loaded, so I'll try and keep it to a short, sweet answer too. For that. Constitution of the boards, in my opinion, needs to be kept small. A big committee, big board cannot work properly. You land up just passing work around and around and nothing happens. So in my opinion, the number is sort of around about 8, so that you have enough people that you can have a quorum at a regular basis. And the who should be on that board? One needs to make sure that if it is a board that is, for example, looking after the standards writing, that on that board you have people that actually understand what the purpose of that entity is, and not just there for the sake of being there. We have had a very good system over very many years of volunteers in the country. My personal opinion is that people should not be paid for that task, and then you get the right people. But that's obviously a very tricky situation because some people feel they do need to be paid for that. But that's more a personal gripe than probably an association point of view. It is, in my opinion, also important that one has the members of the other SQAM institutes together on that board. So that when you, if you were to take, say, the SANAS board and you're looking at the accreditation functions, you want to have input into that board what is happening on the metrology side of the world, what is happening with the standard writing side, etc., so that when each of those entities sets about their business, they are forced to a degree to work with each other and make sure that all of these entities are pulling in the same direction. So that's quite a tough order to do, to keep the numbers down and still have representation from industry on there as well. Regarding the forums, these do not need to be an expensive or a very big event. The current, if we look at the SANAS model where you have the RAF as the advisory forum, that meets once or twice a year. It is in a fairly big room. It is, you get a very, very wide range of people, including all of the various ministries represented and so on, who have the opportunity to be there, and industry in its various forms to be there. The cost of that is going to be the higher the room and tea, and if you want to be generous, throw some biscuits or something in as well. So that's about it, and I believe the state should carry that cost. It's minor. The last question related really to capacity and then problems. The problems that we have seen with a very disjointed process of regulators is you get regulators sitting in various ministries that have been given a job to do that do not really, with all due respect to them, understand the process. They are given a difficult job to do and no supporting tools to help them. If it was brought into a single unified body, such as the bill is setting out to do, you can make sure that the various support structures are there for them, and you get harmonization in the way that the regulators approach the task that they do. I don't know if that answers the question. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, sir. There's yet another question or comment coming. Then, please.
Just one question of clarity, please, Chairperson. On the the regulator. You said you want a clear, independent regulator. Can you just elaborate on that, maybe to give us a clear light as just whether what is on the bill now is satisfactory or not?
Mr. Chair, the emphasis on the word independent is effectively a stab at the way SABS operates at the moment, and the way it's structured, where you have the regulator inside the SABS, and at times that process isn't very independent. I would say that it's been cleaned up a lot, but it is still a long way from correct. So it needs to be clearly independent of other influences and commercial influences. Does that answer the question?
Mentally, could you kindly switch on your mic, and then you with supplementary.
I just wanted to say, it's not clear enough, but if time allows us, maybe you could clarify us more what you mean by saying it's not clear enough. Because if you just say it's not clear enough, then you leave us in the dark. It calls for more questions to ask.
Mr. Wilson, perhaps before you answer, it might help to also remember that members of parliament are not there with you on a day-to-day basis. It's a specialized field. So it might help to give an illustrative example. Then we can contextualize the theoretical aspects.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm treading a little bit on thin ice, so you'll forgive me if I get some of the technicality wrong to pull the example together. If I remember correctly, the regulator for electricity standards, safety standards, resides in the Department of Labor. The medical ones obviously live in the Department of Health. Some of the others live in the DTI, and those are typically housed currently in SATs. And as I said, I'm not exactly sure where all of them live. But if you take one that I, on a more personal level, know in the electrical field, you have regulations that have been put into place that hit a very big public media debate about 2 years ago as to how did such standards actually get passed and how did the regulator actually allow such things to happen.
So the example in question, so that you just refresh
it. It had to do with the wiring standards and tests of homes. And really there was a case of a standard that was very badly written, very badly implemented, and not properly executed by and monitored by the regulator. And that comes back to really what the previous speaker was saying, was that if those processes are followed properly and then measured by a competent body to do that, those things will not happen. Coming back to the initial question, by having regulators in different departments falling under different ministries, the work can never be in a harmonized type of form. Many of them don't even know that we have a national accreditation system, that we have a national measurement laboratory to make sure that those things actually happen. So you land up sometimes duplicating the efforts and having inspectors running around wildly that aren't even trained properly. So that's the type of thing that I meant by it.
Mentally.
Thank you, Sir Professor. Having them totally independent, do you mean having them private? Now, if you are having them private, how do you then finance them?
It would not be private at all. It needs to be a state-driven initiative, as the bill requires for. But it needs to, say they're independent. It is independent of the other organizations, so it's clear who the regulator is. Right at the moment, it's very difficult to actually find the regulators in certain fields, in certain areas. You have to search hard for it, and we've been through that process trying to find who to go to. If you look at things like the intrinsic safety testing for the mining field. We have regulations, Jeff will correct me if I'm wrong in case something has happened recently, is that our regulations bear no semblance to anybody else's in the world. But to talk to that specific department to get those regulations brought in line is almost impossible.
Mr. Wilson, thank you very much. There's a clearer picture. Thanks for your input. I don't see any further hands, nor do I see any foot in there. We can go to the next written submission. Business Unity South Africa. In the house. Welcome, ma'am.
Thank you, Chair. Good afternoon. I'm sorry that I came late, but I had some other commitments in Johannesburg. Chair, thank you very much for allowing us this opportunity. I'd first like to introduce myself. I'm Lorraine Lotter. I'm representing Business Unity South Africa, which I'm sure you've seen us here before. You may recall it's a confederation of business associations. Collectively, the organization represents the sectors contributing in excess of 80% of the gross domestic product. Business Unity South Africa welcomes the introduction of these two bills. We see them as an integral part of the strategy document that Mr. Wilson referred to. We have, as Business Unity South Africa, participated intensively in the NEDAC process on the consideration of the bills and of the strategy. We support the NEDAC report. I hope, Chair, that you have a copy also before you. We believe that through that process that most of the concerns that we originally had with the two bills have been addressed. We support most of the provisions. We do have a few difficulties which we feel are technical in nature and quite easy to address, which we will speak to you about. Chair, there's no doubt that the implementation of these bills is not going to be without challenges, both of them. It's a significant institutional rearrangement, and we stand ready as Business Unity to work with government and the institutions to make sure that the implementation is successful. We believe also that it's important to consider the bills as we considered the previous two bills, the Accreditation and Measurement and Unit Standards Act of bills. We need to recognize the industrial policy context. When we spoke to you before on the other two bills, we were awaiting the publication of the National Industrial Policy Framework and the Industrial Policy Action Plan. We now have those, and we see there that the achievement of the goals of the National Technical Regulatory Strategy are one of the key action plans, which we support very strongly. We believe that industrial policy needs to provide the necessary enabling framework which allows business to do what it is supposed to do, and such an environment also promotes both domestic and foreign investment. We also think that and are pleased to see that the Industrial Policy Action Plan now reflects that it's important for government to look at a much more linked strategy between industrial and trade strategy, that the two need to inform each other. The use of standardization, technical, very clear, unambiguous technical regulations is a key element of trade strategy, particularly facilitating market access in foreign markets. We think that it's possible for the South African government in fact to take a much more assertive approach in respect of technical barriers that we face as business in foreign markets. We believe the establishment of these two institutions can assist us in taking that more assertive approach. We think that it's also important for government and we hope that when we come to the finalization of the export strategy, that we will also recognize the four institutions that, we hope have been established by that time, and to make sure that the work of those institutions is incorporated in the implementation of the export strategy, because it allows us then to have a very strong platform for a more assertive approach to technical barriers which are posed against us. Now, see, if we look at the two bills, I think that one of the important things for us is perhaps, because I realize it may be somewhat controversial to take an institution that has been successful. There is no question about it. The FFES has made a significant contribution to the South African economy, both before 94 and after. And therefore, to seek to radically change that institution is something that has to be given very significant and careful thought. We believe that the consideration that the DPI has given to this task is sufficient. They have really worked hard at trying to address all the problems that could arise from such a change. We believe that to a large extent the bills have addressed what may be challenges in implementing it. And we'd like to perhaps illustrate why we support the establishment of two entities. And we'd like to do that by looking first at the standards bill and the issues there, and also then at the technical regulator for compulsory specifications bill. But, Chair, mindful of the questions that have been asked about the practical challenges, I would like to try and use an example. I come from the chemical sector, so I'll use an example that I understand from that sector. If we look at what is happening in the world in terms particularly of global trade, and we recognize the challenges that all of us, particularly smaller countries, face in getting market access for our goods, we recognize the importance of a country like South Africa adopting where appropriate, not always appropriate, so it has to be adopting where appropriate international standards. Now, it's quite often quite a complex task. It's not something that just anybody can do. You need to know how to do it. And if we look at the example of the obligation of the state to ensure that people are able to produce chemicals, manage chemicals, use chemicals in a way that is not harmful to their health and safety, the state then needs to set certain quite stringent requirements on how such chemicals will be used and in what ways they can be used. Now, in order to do that, it's important to understand what is the risk, what is the danger of a specific chemical. And the way that that is done in the world is that you classify the chemical according to, for example, its level of toxicity, its level of flammability, things like that. Now, there's an international system which allows you to do that, which gives you a broad guide. And if all countries in the world adopt that system, you then only have to classify the chemical once. So a chemical that we produce in South Africa, we classify according to the international system, we export it, that other country recognizes our classification. But the challenge is to take those international requirements and convert them into a document that can be successfully used in South Africa. That is a standard drafting task. You need technical people that understand the international documents and are able to convert it into a document that is compatible also with our legal system. Recently, the SABS has done precisely that, obviously with a technical committee, supported by a technical committee comprising people from various areas of society. Now, once you have that very difficult technical task behind you, and here I may differ slightly, I'm sorry, John, I may differ slightly from Mr. Wilson and Mr. God. Once you have that technical task behind you, then the regulator, which is a government department, is able to take that technical work and incorporate it into a much simpler regulation, where he then says, you must comply with these requirements. He then, in order to make sure that those technical requirements are met, also make use of competent people that understand what the compliance testing requirement is. And all of these facilities, test facilities, inspection facilities, must be accredited. And there you see the link again with the accreditation system. Now, in some cases, particularly when you deal with products more directly, then the Department of Trade and Industry has a very particular task and a very particular obligation. And there, the use of a technical regulator independent of the compliance testing organization is appropriate. So you don't necessarily, in establishing this technical regulator, you are not necessarily establishing a single regulator. You are not removing the existing regulatory powers from other government departments through this bill. And we think that's appropriate. We think that to bring them all into one, quite apart from the political drama that you may encounter, is technically a very difficult task. So it depends on what you're doing, which one you should use. But here, the importance of the separation of the two. If you look at the situation now, you have the SAV as a regulator, independent regulator in a sense, but the compliance testing facilities that they make use of are also owned by the same entity. So it's very difficult for the board currently of the SAV to really try to promote two strategic areas. They're promoting a commercial strategic area where they are asking fees for the rendering of test services, and they're trying to run a regulatory system. We therefore believe that the separation of the two will lead to a much more effective situation. And of course, here, as soon as the state is involved in an institution which charges fees for its services, and those services may also be provided by the private sector for whatever commercial reason, it doesn't matter how you ring-fence the budget, you run the risk of the perception of unfair subsidization and unfair competition. So independence is better all round. There's no question about it. You also have the problem that, and this is a problem that we've experienced, in certain areas of test where there's a compulsory specification in place, the testing facilities of the SABS are overstretched. Because the regulator has to use those test facilities, or it's very difficult for him not to use it, let me rather say, you may wait 6 and 8 weeks for a test of your product, and in that time, before you can demonstrate the compliance, you may not sell that product. So you can be 6 to 8 weeks without income on a particular product. In the scenario now planned by these two bills, the regulator would be able to look for additional testing facilities. It allows him, it gives him much more flexibility, it's a much better situation for him. So that's another reason why we support that. We believe that engagement with stakeholders is becoming increasingly important. Because business is just becoming more complex. Regulation of business is becoming more complex. People are understanding more and more what makes something safe. So there's more and more requirements, health and safety requirements in particular. And I'm sure you're all aware of the very intensive review of the environmental legislation and the much more stringent requirements that are now being introduced in that area. It's therefore important for a standard-setting authority and a technical regulator who would be dealing with those areas that they are able to be kept abreast in the most cost-effective way of the new innovations in the field, the kind of things that we're going to have to pay attention to as a country. And there's nobody that knows that quicker than industry. Because industry, as we're exporting our products and hitting technical barriers, we are able then to alert the standard-setting authority and the regulator that here's something that we need to pay attention to. Of course, also, the other point that's important is that it's important also for industries to have early warning of changes that may be contemplated, either in a technical standard or in the way that the technical regulator is going to work. And generally speaking, if one looks at the relationship between business and the government departments with whom they deal directly, they are always one forum or another where there is direct interaction. And we think it's appropriate that the same kind of process is allowed here. In the case of the standards bill, the government consultative forum is also particularly important to us. We've seen a lot of examples where a regulator like the Department of Labor, the Department of Transport, takes up the national standard as part of its regulation and doesn't fully understand the process and doesn't have a proper engagement with the standards authority, and we think this would facilitate that type of a situation. The one area, Chair, where we are a little bit concerned, the original version of the bill that we discussed with the department contained a section dealing with the incorporation of national standards in legislation. That section has been removed. We would strongly urge you to consider reinserting it. We have provided the text of the original version for your convenience in our submission, but we really think that it was a valuable insertion and that you should strongly consider reinserting it. Another area, Chair, where we are frankly confused, and that is sections 23 and 24. To us, they appear to conflate two different things and therefore are quite confusing. The original version, and in our discussions with the department, it was our understanding that two different standards were being spoken about. The first is a compulsory standard, in a sense, that the standards authority must develop, which tells everybody, sets out for everybody, how national standards are drafted. What is the process? What are the kinds of things that you must take into account? How must the technical committee behave? We think that's an important standard, and recently one has been developed. But the way you deal with that, the almost compulsoriness of it, and the way you gazette it, is completely different. The treatment of it is different from a national standard which may remain voluntary, which may never become mandatory. You need a different process. And we believe that the intention was that Section 23 would deal with the compulsory standard that deals with how you develop standards, and that Section 24 deals with all other national standards. We would therefore suggest that those two sections both be reviewed. Section 23 should clarify the intention that it will deal with the development of any national standard, and then subsections 23, 4, 5, and 6 should be removed from there into Section 24 and slightly redrafted just to be appropriate. But we think if you could make that change, that it would be more accurate. It would more accurately reflect our understanding of the intention, and also the reader would know what's happening. I mean, it's really quite confusing as it is. Then, Chair, this is a difficult area and is not part of the bill. We don't necessarily think that you need to alter the bill, but we think it's something that we would like you to take into account and consider, and not necessarily immediately as you consider the bill, but in future. Increasingly, as we start to use standards as part of our legislation, we need to consider how we would improve accessibility of those standards. At the moment, those standards have to be purchased. We don't purchase laws, lawyers do, but generally speaking, we can get things from websites or whatever. But if you call up, if a standard is part of the law, it's not published as part of the law, unless it's a compulsory certification. And what happens is that you then have to go and buy the standard. The standard that I used in the example, the system of classification of chemicals, costs more than R1,000. It's not a cheap thing. And we think that consideration should be given to making mechanisms of making those standards more accessible. We see that other countries are starting to look at making such standards freely downloadable from their websites, and we think it's something that needs attention in the future. We don't believe that the bill prohibits it. But we just wanted to take the opportunity to say that that is something that we think needs to be taken up in whatever appropriate time. Then, Chair, if we look at the National Regulator for Compulsory Specifications Bill, here we have a few things which we think are worthy of consideration. One of the things that we would like to see here is a more direct possibility of using accredited facilities that are not owned by the entity, by the regulator themselves, to have a more flexible approach, that you would use accredited inspection authorities in some areas. We think that could be more clearly set out. Another area that we're concerned about is that currently we have cases where, in a particular industry, there may be a voluntary standard applicable where the mark is applied for which the company pays a levy, and then there may be a compulsory specification as well. And there's quite often value in having the mark in addition to the compulsory specification, complying with the compulsory specification. But of course, to pay twice for what is essentially the same inspection process is not a good idea. So at the moment, through regulation, under those circumstances, there's an exemption to make sure that people don't pay double. Now, we recognize that the bill allows for existing regulations still to be valid under the new bill. But we believe that that particular possibility, that enabling power, so to speak, which allows there to be that exemption, we think that that should be made explicit in the bill. We think that it would certainly give a lot of industry sectors comfort, because that right, in a sense, would be entrenched. So we would like to look into that. Now, Chair, with this compulsory specification, what sometimes happens is that because the starting point is you can't sell that good if it doesn't comply with the specification. But you may be testing a new type of that good. Then you may be given a sales permit which allows you to sell it under certain conditions. You may have a dispute with the test facility. You may feel that your product you have it tested independently to demonstrate that, and you feel that your product does comply, and the regulator says it doesn't. Under certain circumstances, the regulator may also issue a sales permit. We think that it's important, though, in the bill to be clear that these are conditional. This is not an easy thing. It's only under very specific circumstances. And we think that in Section 14, that could be tightened up. They separate in Section 14 a good that is being tested and a good where there's a special circumstance. And in the one, they give the power to prescribe by regulation, but in the other, not. We think there may be a case to make that consistent. And, Chair, in conclusion, what we would like to say is that we believe these two bills together present us with a very coherent yet complementary approach. We believe they will work very well together. We support the two bills and hope that you would be able to address those few drafting concerns that we still have. Thank you very much.
Dr. Lott, thank you very much for a very full diagnosis. May I suggest that we break for 10 minutes to mull over the brief that you have just had, and then after that we come back with comments and questions. There is tea outside.